1 Samuel chapter 25, beginning in verse 1. Now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him. We begin the chapter with a very major loss for the nation of Israel. I'm sure it sent shockwaves through the promised land as we watch the nation here mourning the passing of a spiritual giant. I'll never forget how I felt when Billy Graham passed away in 2018. I'll never forget how I felt when Chuck Smith passed away in 2013. To me, those were American Samuels. Those were just special guys, special servants of the Lord. And those kind of losses are devastating to those of us who are left behind here on the earth. But we understand that they are glorious celebrations to all of heaven, and especially the person that graduated into eternity. You know, the book of Psalms famously in chapter 116, verse 15 tells us that precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his saints. And humanly speaking, Samuel is one of the best men of God in all of the scriptures. I mean, that's just purely a human statement, right? It's not a spiritual statement. It's not a doctrinally accurate statement, but just humanly speaking, he's one of the greatest guys you'll read about, because not too often do we find a guy that's as special as Samuel is. And not too often will you read about a Bible character where you really have to stretch it to find mistakes, to find faults, and to find sins. Joshua was one of those guys. Joseph was one of those guys. There's not too many of them. David's not one of those guys. But Samuel was. In fact, the only thing I can really find wrong with anything that Samuel did is if I'm seriously nitpicking, and it would be over the issue of the corruption of his sons and Samuel's inactivity to step up and do something about that corruption. Instead of firing his sons, instead of actually correcting them other than giving them a good talking to, Samuel really did nothing there. But again, that's really stretching it, trying to find something that Samuel did wrong in his life. I'm not saying he didn't do stuff wrong. I'm not saying he was without sin or almost without sin. I'm not saying any of that. I know the truth of the scriptures. But I'm just saying that his life was characterized by being a life that was just always on the God side of every single situation. And I do believe that is the best testimony that a person can have. We've talked about this some in chapter 12. That was the chapter where Samuel retired as a judge over the nation of Israel and then turned the reins over to the new king. And he opened up the podium there in chapter 12 and really gave the offer to the nation that, hey, if there's anyone here that I've wronged in any way, if there's someone that would like to come up and take the podium and make an accusation about me and tell me how I've done wrong and how I've negatively affected them, come on up. And no one came up. And they agreed with the allusion of his statement that, you know, Samuel, you've never done anything but bless us and help us. No one had any dirt on the guy. He's just the guy that never did anything but please the Lord and try to bless the Lord's people. I know it can at times seem like the worse the past, the better the testimony. You ever feel like that? Like you give your testimony and you tell about how awful you were pre-conversion. And then the next person gets up and they tell their testimony and man, they were even worse than you. Their depths were even deeper. They came through even tougher stuff and you're like, oh man, their testimony's better than mine. You ever feel like that? We shouldn't feel like that. I mean, it's great when, you know, the testimonies have those desperate cases, those hopeless cases where the Lord broke through and saved and delivered, because that shows us the far reaches of God's grace. We need to see that. But if we're being honest, the best kind of testimony you can have is something like this. Well, I grew up in church. I've been going to church. You know, in my case, I'm 49 years old. I've been going to church for 49 years and 9 months because I was going, my mom, when I was in the womb, was taking me to church. It's a testimony like this. I've been going to church all my life. I've been taught to love the Lord, and I have. And eventually, past the age of accountability, I made the decision. I made it official to follow after the Lord. And I've, by God's grace, done the best with it that I can after that. I've done my best to walk faithfully with the Lord. That's Samuel's testimony. And I think that's the best kind of testimony. I mean, isn't that better? Think about that. Someone, you know, that can say, I never robbed a convenience store, never beat anyone to a bloody pulp with a baseball bat, never did drugs, never smoked weed. I mean, the testimonies of how the Lord has saved folks that were mixed up in those things is wonderful, but what a great testimony to be able to say, no, I just never did that. You know, I was raised to love the Lord, and I tried to stick with that as closely as possible all my life. So, you know, that's why Samuel is such a special guy, because that's his testimony. He started at like 2 or 3 years old. From the time he was a toddler, he was working in the tabernacle serving the Lord. He did that all throughout his early, you know, youth. And then early in his youth, he began to operate the gift of prophecy and become a prophet for the Lord, for the nation. He's been doing that, acting as a prophet for the nation from his youth to his death here. So that is just an awesome testimony from a humanly speaking awesome brother in the Lord. And we continue on in verse 1. It says, and they buried him in his house at Ramah. By the way, that is the direction I want to go as well. Should I die before the Lord returns, I would just like to be buried under the house. It would work perfectly at my house. We just have a dirt crawl space under there. So, you know, you just cut out some floorboard, dig a little hole, pop me down in there, cover me up. But I do want to let you know, I'll make sure it's done right. I do want to make sure I get a medical professional to give me the, you know, the official death clearance and rule out homicide. And the reason I say that is because, like, if I go missing for a couple months and eventually they find me buried under the house, Maggie's got some answering to do, all right? So I'm going to do it right, but that is the way I want to do it. Reading on in verse 1, and really this next part should be attached to verse 2 because it's in text, part of verse 2. But it says, then David rose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. That's about 80 to 100 miles from where David and his men were in En-Gedi. And it says in verse 2, and there was a man in Maon. Yes, again, that's the proper pronunciation. I know you guys think every time I pronounce it that way that I'm just setting myself up for a joke, but that's the way it's actually pronounced, Maon. There was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. Too bad his business wasn't in Maon, because then when people would ask him about his business, he would say, my business is my own. All right, that would be great. Unfortunately, his business was in Carmel. That's not as funny, even if you try like the candy bar factory joke. It's not as good. Whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. Listen, if you had like a half a dozen of each, you were like middle class. So to have 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats, you're like, you know, obscenely wealthy. He's an obscenely wealthy man. I don't know if I'd quite put him at Abraham levels. You remember that guy? He had so much livestock that him and Lot had to part ways, because the land wasn't big enough for their livestock. He's not maybe Abraham level wealthy, but he's like obscenely wealthy. And it says he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Do you remember from chapter 23 when we talked about the grain harvest and how that was a very vulnerable time for a little community? When they all got together on that day to do their grain harvest, and then they, you know, carried it in, they harvested, they brought it in, they threshed it. And then as it was finished being threshing, it was down to just the product, and that was a vulnerable time where more than likely Philistine raiders might drop in unannounced and try to run off with their crop. Well, it's kind of the same way with sheep shearing day. Remember, for grain harvest, if they were able to successfully get all of that grain into their storehouses without it getting stolen by the Philistines, that they would have a big feast at the end of the night. Remember we talked about all that? Same thing for sheep shearing day. If you successfully made it through sheep shearing day without the enemy running off with the wool that you've just harvested from your sheep, then on that night you'd have a big celebration, a big feast. You'd have a big dinner to celebrate that all of the work was done, none of it got stolen by an enemy of any sort, and it's safely in our storehouses, which means now nothing left to do but sit back and either enjoy the product or sell the product and make lots of money. So that's where we are here in the story. Verse 3. Now the name of the man was Nabal, and Nabal means fool. Nabal is actually the Hebrew word for fool. His name means fool, not F-U-L-L. F-O-O-L. That's what his name means. Now, I'm not sure if it's a given name or a nickname, but it had to be one or the other. Either his parents predicted the fool that he'd become, or his friends recognized it and nicknamed him fool. One way or another, his name is fool. And it says, and the name of his wife, Abigail, and Abigail means my father's joy. And then it says, the woman was discerning and beautiful, but the man was harsh and badly behaved. He was a Calebite. These are two very opposite extremes. You know, Nabal, it seems, was his father's regret, more than likely. But Abigail was his father's joy. Nabal was a fool, and Abigail was very intelligent and sensible. He was a big old jerk, and she's just a beautiful person inside and out. So how do two people like this end up getting together? Probably the same way me and Maggie did. It's true. One of us is very sensible and intelligent. The other one is just a problem. You know, and I'll let you determine which one you think is which. That's all I'll say. Okay, you know what? I will say this. In spite of Maggie being so intelligent and sensible, we still managed to make it work. There, I just told you who the problem child was. No, more than likely, Nabal and Abigail became married through an arranged marriage. That's probably what happened. My assumption, which is probably a safe assumption, would be that her parents just could not turn down the offer of marrying her off to a family as wealthy as Nabal's family. And you see how that is. As a parent, you want your child to be taken care of. You don't know the guy's a fool. Maybe he doesn't look like a fool, but he's filthy rich. So you know if you marry your daughter off to that guy, she's forever financially taken care of. It would at least be a temptation. And note here that we were told that Nabal was a Calebite. You know what that means, right? That means he comes from the line of Caleb. You remember Caleb from first and second generation Israel wandering through the promised land. He was one of only two guys that went into Canaan as spies and had eyes of faith and come back with a good report. The other one was Joshua. So, consequently, he was one of two, just Caleb and Joshua, that were allowed by God to enter into the promised land 40 years later, approximately, when they were once again at the doorstep of the promised land. So, don't forget, though, Caleb, from everything we can tell in the scriptures, was not actually born a Jew from the line of Jacob, but was actually a Canaanite who was converted and assimilated into the nation of Israel. He was a Gentile that was welcomed in and accepted as an honorary Jew there in the nation of Israel. We're told that Caleb was the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite. Now, the Kenizzite clan that came from the city of Kenaz, which was a Canaanite city. So this was a Gentile that converted, became an honorary Jew, and then ends up being, like, you know, one of the best. That's the family tree that Nabal the fool is from. So it would seem that though he came from a very good tree, this was one nut that fell a little too far from the tree. He didn't have the same respectable character, the same levels of faith and closeness to God as did his ancestor Caleb. We read in verse 4, David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing the sheep. So that means, you know, David knows this is a big day for Nabal and his family, for all of his workers. He knows on that very night there's going to be a gigantic feast. So David wants to get a special message to Nabal. He says in verse 5, so David sent 10 young men. I won't tell you what that's about other than that kind of reveals to you David's level of expectations here. If he's sending 10 men, you're going to find out in a minute what he's sending them for. But whatever he's sending them for, just remember this, he's got 10 guys that he thinks he's going to need to get that all accomplished, all right? So David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, go up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name. So, you know, tell him that David sent you. Verse 6, and thus shall you greet him. Here's what I want you to say to him. Verse 6, peace be to you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. Basically, we come in peace. We wish you well. Verse 7, I hear that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we did them no harm, and they missed nothing all the time that they were in Carmel. Verse 8, ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we have come on a feast day. What a coinkydink. We have come on a feast day. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son David. Okay, so do you see what just happened there? Unbeknownst to all of us, not to Nabal, Nabal would have known this, but unbeknownst to all of us, David's men, for quite some time, have been providing security for Nabal's shepherds and his sheep. When he says they missed nothing at all, that simply means we were right there with your sheep, and we didn't steal and barbecue a single one of them. So you weren't missing any of your sheep because of us. But it also means we were a force of protection for you. We were a security force for you. Because not only did we steal any of your sheep, but we didn't let any of the filthy Philistines do it either. And we didn't even let any wild animals steal your sheep. We protected your goods, and we made sure that your shepherds didn't have to worry about protecting the flock. All they had to do was be concerned about feeding the sheep, having them in good pasture, you know, stuff that shepherds should do if they have a good security force around them. It was all handled by David and his boys. But remember, David and his men, they're still in hiding. They're still running from Saul, trying to avoid him. It is a military, but this is not a funded military. They don't have a Defense Department budget. What? War Department now, right. They don't have a War Department budget. They have hundreds, perhaps thousands of people to try to take care of them. And here's the really bad part. Not a single one of them has a job because they're all outlaws. They can't get jobs. They can't make money. So their survival at this time pretty much depends on scavenging and handouts, the mercy of generous people. So that's what David's doing here. He's asking for a handout. Basically, he's saying, we've just provided services for you. And if you've appreciated our services, here's a tip jar. You're welcome to give us a donation. And I'm convinced that David and his men really did this out of the kindness of their heart. I think they did it because David's a shepherd at heart, and he loves sheep, and, you know, he's for the commoner. He's for the little guy. Now, Nabal's not exactly a small player, but he's a commoner. He doesn't want the Philistines coming in there or wild animals coming in there and wreaking havoc on that flock. I believe he did it out of the kindness of his heart. I don't think this was, like, planned out, like, months in advance. You know, David saying, hey, there's a very wealthy guy. I got an idea. Here's what we do. Let's just take 2 or 3 months. Let's provide security for this really filthy rich guy. And then when they do their feast day, you know, 2-3 months from now, then we'll show up, we'll hold out the tip jar, and the guy's going to feel way too bad to turn us away and not give us a tip. I'm convinced David didn't like scheme this out and say, guys, just hang in there. Let's provide this service for 2 or 3 months, and then we'll all get a free meal. I don't think he was doing that. I think he was just doing this out of the kindness of his heart, but now recognizes his sort of desperate need for his little mini nation that the Lord is raising up around him. And it says in verse 9, when David's young men came, they said all this to Nabal. So they relayed this message on to Nabal in the name of David. And then they waited. Verse 10. And Nabal answered David's servants, who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? Well, it sounds like he actually knows who David is. If you know enough about David to know that he's the son of David, I think you're playing games. I think you actually know who David is. I don't think he's trying to say, I've never heard of you before. I think what he's saying is, who are you to ask for a handout from me? You're a nobody. That's the way that I read this. Who is David? Who are you? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Ouch. Okay. I think we know where this guy stands on the whole. Who's right, Saul or David? I think we know where this guy stands on who caused this rift, Saul or David. Who's the problem, Saul or David? Who's the innocent party, Saul or David? And I think he just made it very clear he views David as the rebellious one. He views David as the guy that revolted against Saul. He views Saul as the innocent party. And clearly he's loyal to Saul and is not about to help David out in any kind of way. He was okay with accepting David's help, but he's not about to help David out. And hey, whatever, you know, everyone is entitled to their opinion, but here's where we really have the problem. The problem really is the insult. He didn't need to insult David. All he had to do was say, look, we're a little tight around here. Well, I guess that'd be a lie. Look, I'm just not going to give you a handout. That's all he had to say. He didn't have to insult David. This insult is going to cause an awful lot of trouble in this chapter. Verse 11, he continues on. He's ranting a little bit now. Offended and affronted that David would ask for a handout. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shearers? Do you sense a little greed here? I, me, my. I sense a little greed here. It's all about him. I think maybe that's the reason, the real reason that David isn't getting the handout. It's really probably greed. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men who come from I do not know where? Touche. I guess. Major burn. What a weirdo, right? Men who come from I do not know where. Who talks like that? Verse 12. So David's young men turned away and came back and told him all this. And we have nothing to worry about, right? David's been in worse situations. He's going to handle this just fine, isn't he? I mean, look at all the stuff Saul put him through. Saul has made his life a disaster, one after another, and David's just handled it all perfectly fine. David never once would lash out and fire back. So we don't have to worry about David taking vengeance upon himself, do we? I mean, he gave us that whole discourse in chapter 24. Oh, I'd never take the vengeance away from that. That's the Lord. Let the Lord handle it. It's the Lord's problems. It's the Lord's enemies, right? David's not going to let this little issue cause him a problem, is he? Well, about that, we better keep reading. Verse 13, and David said to his men, every man strap on his sword. And every man of them strapped on his sword. David also strapped on his sword. And about 400 men went up after David, while 200 remained with the baggage or the supplies. Verse 14, but one of the young men, one of the shepherds who were there and overheard all of this, told Abigail, Nabal's wife, behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to greet our master, and he, Nabal, railed at them. He insulted them. See, that's the problem here. He insulted them. That's what brought out the swords, the insult. Not the fact that he didn't give him a handout, that's understandable. But the fact that he insulted David and his men. Verse 15, yet the men were very good to us. David and his guys, man, we loved their help. They were awesome. And it says, we suffered no harm and we did not miss anything when we were in the fields. What do they mean when they say miss anything? I guess I've covered it, right? That means no sheep came up missing. That's what that means. And he's saying it again. This is the shepherd now saying it. Look, we didn't lose a single sheep while we were hanging around with David and his security force. We did not miss anything when we were in the fields. As long as we went with them, verse 16, they were a wall of protection to us both by night and by day. All the while we were with them keeping the sheep. Okay, so now the way that I read this is that David and his men were doing more than just protecting the sheep. You read that right. It wasn't David and his men following the sheep and the shepherds around. It's the other way around. We just read it. Twice he says it, that it was actually that the shepherds and the sheep were following David and his men around. So I think David wasn't just protecting them, but David was being an expert shepherd. And he was able to say, you know, come over here. This is a safe place and really good pasture over there. I know these areas. I've had sheep out here before. This is a good spot to be. Bring them over here. We got that wall of protection over there. We'll watch this side. You're going to be good right here. So David, just falling back on his experience, I think, was a huge help and a huge asset to these men and their sheep. That's his background. He's very dedicated and gifted shepherd at one point in his life. So this kind of work is right up his alley. He has an affinity for the work. He has skill in the work. And it seems to me that he was able to help them tremendously with their shepherding. Verse 17, now therefore know this and consider what you should do. For harm is determined against our master and against all his house. And he is such a worthless man. Literally a son of Belial or a child of the devil. He is such a worthless man that one cannot speak to him. I really like that Abigail and the servants and the shepherds, they can all talk about Nabal like this. You know, you're married to him. You know what kind of a jerk he is. You know he's worthless. You know you can't get anything through that thick skull of his. He's just never going to get it. And she's like, yeah, I know. Tell me about it. I just like that. Any other situation, that dude would have just been fired for calling his master such a worthless man. But she's like, yeah, I get it. Reading on, verse 18. Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves of bread and 2 skins of wine and 5 sheep already prepared. That means already chopped up and cooked up, ready to eat. And 5 seahs of parched grain. That would be about 10 or 11 dry gallons. So that's a lot. And 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of figs, you know, little Debbie's. 1000 BC version. And she laid them on donkeys. Now, how did she get all this stuff together so quickly? My goodness. She's like, I got to get all this stuff out, all this food out to David. How does she get this all done? So it's cooked, it's ready. How did this come about so quickly? Well, remember, they're having a huge feast tonight. So her and the servants, they've probably been in the kitchen all day cooking, preparing this meal. You know how Thanksgiving is. You like start 3 days out working on that meal. Well, not me personally, but some people. So they're working on this meal for a long time. They've got everything cooked, ready to go. And all she does is just like take a small portion of it. You're going to see this as a feast fit for a king. She just takes a small portion of it. It's already ready to eat. And she's going to send that ahead to David. It says that in verse 19. And she said to her young men, "Go on before me. Behold, I come after you." But she did not tell her husband the fool, Nabal. She did not tell Nabal. So she wants the food and the wine to get to David first. Obviously, she's trying to soften him up. She's trying to get out ahead of this. She's trying to get on this as soon as she can. And she wants it to be that by the time that she gets there to verbally try to intervene and talk David down, that maybe the gifts that preceded her will have softened his heart a little bit and helped to accomplish that. And of course, she doesn't want her husband to know about this, of course, because this is exactly what Nabal has refused David. And now she's just taking it and secretly giving what they requested to David and his men without the knowledge of her husband. I can't say I would encourage all of the things that Abigail does here regarding her husband, the things that are said about him. You're going to find out shortly what I'm talking about. The things that are said about him, the way she goes behind his back. I won't say that's justified or condoned, but I think we kind of understand the man that she's trying to work around here, the problem that he is, the worthless, foolish fellow that he is. She's doing her best, so we give her some grace here. It says in verse 20, "And as she rode on the donkey and came down under cover of the mountain, behold, David and his men came down toward her, and she met them." So if you were watching a Western, this would say right here that she cut them off at the pass. That's what happened. She cut them off at the pass. Now, verse 21 gives us for the first time the actual full words of David. All we've read so far is that David told his men to strap on their swords, and they strapped on their swords, and there were servants or shepherds that were present when that took place, so they were able to go and tell Abigail, "David is coming and he means harm. We're all in danger. You're full of a husband. He's going to get us all killed." That's all that we've been told so far. But these guys know the full story. They know everything that David said here. We're just now getting it, but these guys already know that. So let's read it in verse 21. It says, "Now David had said, 'Surely in vain have I guarded all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he has returned me evil for good.'" Verse 22. "God do so to the enemies of David and more also, if by morning I leave so much as one male of all who belong to him." I think it goes without saying that this is a pretty severe overreaction on David's part. Yes, Nabal insulted him. It wasn't a good thing, but now David is so furious that he is on his way to, in cold blood, murder this guy, Nabal, and not just Nabal, but every single male that is connected to this guy. You realize that means even the shepherds that they've been protecting for the last 2 or 3 months? David's ready to go in there and hack them all to pieces, all because this fool of a guy has insulted him, and it's made him a little angry. I mean, this is crazy. Seeing the heart condition of David like this. When King Saul was hunting David down, trying to kill David, and David, in what seemed like it could have been a twist of fate where David now had a chance to take Saul's life, what did he do? He wanted no part of it. He refused to take matters into his own hands. He refused to enact vengeance himself. And he would say, you know, well, the Lord is going to handle it. Let the Lord take vengeance, not me. I'm not going to do it. But now an unknown fool has criticized him, and he is fixing to take vengeance into his own hands here. And he's like, you know, Lord, you can just handle the part like if you read it. Like, Lord, if I miss anyone, am I going there and kill all of them? If I happen to miss any of them, then Lord, may your vengeance take those ones out that I missed. That's what he just told us. Chapter 24, David, and chapter 25, David, are very different men. I think we talked about being double-minded last week. Well, there you go. Chapter 24, David, is very different from chapter 25, David. What's so different about the circumstances? It had me wanting to look into this. Why did this rattle him? But like nothing else has rattled this guy so far. Well, let's see. In chapter 24, Saul and Saul's soldiers were known enemies. He knew about them, and he knew about them in advance. Those were public enemies. Those were large-scale enemies. It was pretty obvious to David that he was being tested based upon his calling. So because of all that stuff, we read it. David dug deep. He prayed about it a lot. We read that from his own Psalms. He was pouring this out in prayer, bathing it in prayer before the Lord, knowing about it in advance. He had time to reflect on Torah and apply the word and stand on the word. Man, he passed with flying colors. He did an awesome job. Well, what's different about chapter 25? Chapter 25, Nabal is an unknown enemy. He's a fool that David wasn't expecting to insult him, pardon me. It was more of a personal matter, a personal attack on David's character. It's small scale. And for some reason, it seems to blindside David so completely that he doesn't take the time to stop and recognize it as a test. He doesn't take the time to pray about it. You know, if he prayed about it, this would go different, right? Lord, should I go in there and kill them all? Yeah, Lord. Okay, gotcha. Yeah, you know this would go different. He hasn't prayed about it. He's not reflecting on Torah. In this moment, for this fool that's come out of nowhere, it just completely blindsides him and catches him completely off guard. And I do think that's the way it is the majority of time. Most of the time, it's not the known enemies that you know about in advance and you're praying about and you're searching the scriptures over and you're preparing to handle. Usually it's the worthless fools that come out of nowhere, that blindside you, the people that you aren't expecting, that say something negative to insult your character, something fairly minor, but something you weren't prepared for. And so you fail that test. It's not the test that you knew about in advance and that you study for that earn you the F's, usually, is it? Usually it's the pop quizzes you didn't know were coming, because the pop quizzes, the stuff that comes out of nowhere and blindsides you, what that reveals is what you actually know. That's what pop quizzes reveal. The tests, all that tells you is, okay, they studied to answer the answers correctly. Or, you know, in the case of a spiritual test, okay, they prepared for this test specifically so they were able to handle it. But the pop quizzes, the tests from the Lord that come out of nowhere, what that reveals is, do you actually know the word? Are you actually living the life? It reveals that. So when the worthless fools of life come out of the woodwork, that's a great way to find out if you really do know the word and live it. It's also a great way, I think, to find out if there's still maybe just a little bit of fool inside of you. You know, the Bible says, don't answer a fool according to his folly. That tells me, don't sink to their level. Just because a fool shoots his mouth off to you, that doesn't mean you have to sink to that level. That doesn't mean you have to get down in the muck with them. So this is revealed in those blindside tests that we get. Maybe a lot of them happen on the highway. You've been facing gigantic spiritual tests and passing them with flying colors. You started your day well in prayer and in the Word. Devotion time was wonderful. Time with the spouse, the kids, the friends, wonderful. Then you left for work. And some worthless fool flipped you off after he cut you off. This literally just happened to me. I was driving past, on 119, past 40. And I had to get off on the exit there for Lowe's and what else is up there? I just drew a blank. Taco Bell. That's really the most important things there off that exit. And someone was coming from 40 and I watched the guy. I mean, he was way behind me and he sped up. He come flying. And I thought, okay, well, the guy wants to go in front of me. That's fine. He's got plenty of time. But when he gets even with me, he slows down and he matches my speed. So I'm like, oh boy. Okay, now I'm going to have to move or else this guy's going to hit me, this worthless fool. No, I didn't say that. This guy's going to hit me. We got to be careful, right? Jesus had some stern words to say about not calling people fool, didn't he? Well, this guy comes right dead even with me. So I look in the mirror and I'm ready to hit my turn signal. And just then the guy behind me got impatient. He comes out around me. So I'm stuck. And I'm just doing my thing. I keep my speed. He's keeping his speed. And I'm like, I'm fine here. I'm stuck. I'm on 119. I'm going the speed limit. At least it's a good enough statement for the sake of this story. I was real close to it. I was doing mostly the right thing. And I'm thinking, he's the one with the yield sign, right? So he's going to have to yield. I'm not going to slow down. I'm not going to speed up. I would have moved over. I can't now. I'm just going to do the right thing, and he's going to have to do the right thing. Well, he sees it at last minute, I guess. He finally decided to look, see if there was someone on the other side of him where he was trying to merge, and he had to hit his brakes pretty hard, come out behind me, and then as he passed me, he flipped me the middle finger. I'm like, this is unbelievable. And I was starting to lose my cool. I was having a good day, too. I'm spiritually on a high. And like this guy, I won't say Nabal, but this guy out of nowhere flips me off. And I was about to lose my cool. I actually honestly thought to myself, that guy is so lucky this was not the pre-saved Arlen. Because I will tell you what the pre-saved Arlen would have done. I would have got off that exit so fast, hopped right back on. I would have drove until he stopped. You know what? It's not important that you know what I would have done. What's important is that this one blindsided me, caught me off guard. I took it as a personal insult to me. And what could I do? Went and bought stuff, forgot all about it, did my thing, and let the Lord soothe that. We have to do that. We can't let fools, I'm not calling him a fool, but we can't let fools drag us down into the muck with them. Verse 23, when Abigail saw David, she hurried and got down from the donkey and fell before David on her face and bowed to the ground. Verse 24, she fell at his feet and said, on me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. Now, if you don't already absolutely love this person, this lady, Abigail, I think this is going to help. She's completely sacrificial here. She's done absolutely nothing wrong. If anything, the only thing she's done wrong is marry a worthless fool. But she's willing to take the fall for this fool here. She's willing to be the lady that takes all of the heat from David just so that her family, her friends, her servants, her workers, just so that all of their lives can be spared. Reading on in verse 23. Please let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. She's used servant twice. So that means she's submitting herself to David's kingship. She's recognizing him as the rightful king over Israel. So Nabal may have his King Saul signs stuck in the yard at home. But it's not an all-Saul home. There's a secret loyal to David member in that home. Verse 25, she says, let not my Lord, as in ruler or king, let not my Lord regard, and she's talking about her husband here, Regard this worthless fellow Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal, fool, is his name, and folly or foolishness is with him. So fool is his name, and foolishness is his game. A fool's gonna fool. He's a fool, and he does foolish stuff. So she says, but I, your servant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. And what she means by that is when you sent the 10 men, you know, I'm really sorry, but they had to end up having this interaction with my husband, the fool. I'm sorry I didn't see those 10 guys that you sent. If I saw them, I would have talked to them. I would have made sure that none of this happened. You know, sorry about the whole thing. Sounds to me like she's kind of responsible for doing this a lot. Like someone shows up to the house, her fool of a husband, shoots his mouth off, causes a problem. She walks the person to the door and she just kind of talks everything down and fixes everything. Okay. Yeah, we're all right. Thank you. Thank you for understanding. He's a little out there. You know, it seems like she's used to doing this, but anyway, she's a little late with the fix, but not too late. She's gonna fix this. Verse 26. Now then, my Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, because the Lord has restrained you from blood guilt and from saving with your own hand, that would be vengeance. Now then, let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my Lord be as Nabal. So what she does in verse 26 is pretty brilliant. This woman is pretty brilliant. She's credited David with restraint. She's crediting him. Oh, thank you so much that you're too good of a guy to ever think about, you know, taking vengeance into your own hands. Thank you for just being of such high moral character that you would never do anything like that. She's crediting him with this in advance. She's doing one of those things. Oh, I'm so grateful that you're such a kind and forgiving guy that you're going to let this little conflict that happened slide and that everything's going to be okay. I'm glad you're not a man that takes matters into his own hands. She's complimenting him on something good that she wants him to do that he has definitely not agreed to yet. She's kind of like leading and directing him with her compliment so that if he wants compliment to be true, he's got to do what she's saying, right? It's brilliant. I thought about trying this at home, like, Maggie, thank you for loving me so much that even though it's late on a Wednesday night, you'd hop in the vehicle and drive to the store and buy me some snacks. That is so amazing. I might try it. If I do, I'll let you know how it turns out. But just remember these things that I teach you. Use them wisely. With great power comes great responsibility. Verse 27. Now let this present that your servant has brought to my Lord be given to the young men who follow my Lord. Verse 28. Please forgive the trespass of your servant, for the Lord will certainly make my Lord a sure house, because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord, and evil shall not be found in you so long as you live. She's just laying it on pretty thick, isn't she? She's not done yet. David, you're just too good of a man to do something evil like this. You're too big for this. You're too important to God to let some fool come along and stumble you like this and just wreck everything for you. I just know that you won't go through with it. Just remember that when you're tempted to lose your cool over a fool. Remember that. Don't get down in the muck with him. It's not worth it. You're too important. You're too important to the Lord. You're too important to this church. Then for us to have to go bail you out of jail because you beat someone to a bloody pulp with a baseball bat. A fool. So, I mean, she's really pouring it on thick here. And David just probably keeps feeling smaller. Smaller and smaller and smaller, because he knows what he had planned in his heart. Verse 29, if men rise up to pursue you, to seek your life, the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living in the care of the Lord our God. And the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the hollow of a sling. She's like, David, you know, and this is stuff he knew in chapter 24. The Lord's going to take care of your battles. They're not really your battles. You don't have to fight them. You don't have to do this stuff. The Lord's protecting you. The Lord's going to take out your enemies. You got nothing to worry about. Let the Lord fight your battles. He'll take care of all of that for you. Verse 30. And when the Lord has done to my Lord according to all the good that He has spoken concerning you and has appointed you prince over Israel. Verse 31, my Lord shall have no cause of grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause, or for my Lord working salvation himself. That again would be vengeance. And when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your servant. Oh man, she finished so strong here, didn't she? She's like, oh, you know, David, the Lord is going to come through for you. He's going to make you king. Look, I wouldn't want you when you become king to have these kind of regrets. Like if you go through and kill all of our men right now, that's going to come back to haunt you. Your conscience is going to bother you over that. The day is going to come when you're larger than life and this little stuff wouldn't matter. Why let this be something that's going to end up being on your conscience for a long time? Why let a fool cause you to stumble? Verse 32, and David said to Abigail, blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. So in verse 33, David is going to bless Abigail for intervening, but first he wants to stop and bless the Lord for sending someone to intervene in this situation and talk him down. So he says in verse 33, blessed be your discretion and blessed be you who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from working salvation with my own hand. You've kept me from lashing out and taking vengeance into my own hands. Verse 34, for as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has restrained me from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to meet me. Truly by morning, there had not been left to Nabal so much as one male. David's saying, I'm not bluffing here. I was really going to do this. I was going to slaughter every single one of your men. Verse 35. Then David received from her hand what she had brought him, and he said to her, go up in peace to your house. See, I have obeyed your voice, and I have granted your petition. Verse 36. And Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast in his house, like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. So she told him nothing at all until the morning light. I mean, he's a fool without the wine, without the drunkenness, so... yeah, you definitely don't want to have this conversation with a drunk fool. She waits till morning, verse 37. In the morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him, and he became a stone. Or he became as a stone. So it seems that this news has gotten Nabal so worked up that he has had a medical incident here of some sort. It sounds like the description of a heart attack. And it sounds like his heart actually stopped for a little while. And it says he became as a stone. So that means he was completely unresponsive for a little while. And for all intents and purposes, it seemed as though he had died. But never fear. He's not dead here. He's not dead in verse 37. He survived this. Okay, reading on verse 38. And about 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal and he died. Okay, now he's dead. Now he's dead. All right, now you can worry about him. 10 days later, 10 days after the medical incident, he dies permanently. And see, the Lord took care of this problem all by himself. This is, the Lord didn't do this in response to anything David did or didn't do. This was God's plan. This is what God was going to do. All David had to do was wait one day. And I know he didn't kill him on the following morning after sheep shearing day, after the feast. But on the next day, he had the medical incident that would eventually claim his life 10 days later. All David had to do was wait. Look how close David came to such a horrible decision, all because, you know, he wouldn't have ended up waiting that last final day. How often are we taught that in the Bible? Just wait on the Lord. Pray about it. Wait on the Lord. Verse 39, when David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, blessed be the Lord, who has avenged the insult I received at the hand of Nabal and has kept back his servant from wrongdoing. The Lord has returned the evil of Nabal on his own head. Then David sent and spoke to Abigail to take her as his wife. I wish we could go into detail about this, but we're kind of running short on time here. Apparently, David also noticed what was stated in verse 3, that Abigail was discerning and beautiful. So now, as of verse 38, she's a widow, and she's not a widow long. David wastes no time in trying to snatch her up. Verse 40. When the servants of David came to Abigail at Carmel, they said to her, David has sent us to take you to him as his wife. Verse 41. And she said, I'm sorry. It's just too recent. This just happened. I'm not ready. I was married to such a great man. I loved him so much. He's going to take a while to get over. Okay, no, that's not what she said. And she rose and bowed with her face to the ground and said, behold, your handmaid is a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord. Verse 42, and Abigail hurried. She hurried and rose and mounted a donkey, and her five young women attended her. She followed the messengers of David and became his wife. She did not hesitate to become his wife. It didn't take her all of a day to get over Nabal after his passing. Verse 43, David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel, and both of them became his wives. Verse 44, Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Palti, the son of Laish, who was of Galim. Now, I'd love to talk about David's marital situations here. Is this right? Is this wrong? Is this okay? He was married to Michal. Saul has taken Michal back and given Michal to another man. So Abigail's wife number two, but he's only got one wife when he marries Abigail. But now this other lady, Ahinoam, comes along and he marries her too. So now he's got two wives at the same time. And oh, he's not done there. He's going to end up in 2 Samuel chapter 3, he's going to end up sending out for Michal, and he's going to say, I want Michal back as my wife, and he'll get her back. So he'll have three wives, and he's going to end up having, if memory serves, eight wives and a handful of concubines. And if you think that's bad, his son's going to top that by a landslide, and Solomon's going to have 700 wives and 300 concubines. Did I get that right, or is it vice versa? Let me think. Yeah, 700 wives and 300 concubines. How does the Lord feel about polygamy? You know what? Let's not handle it tonight. We've talked about it before, and we'll leave it at that for now. We have plenty of time to talk about all of David's wives that will be coming along in the stories. But let's stand and let's go before the Lord in prayer. You let me teach for an hour tonight. I appreciate that. I generally don't go that long. But I knew this was going to be a long chapter. That's why I purposefully didn't include an introduction. Thank you for giving me an hour to teach tonight. And now may the Lord take everything that's been said and do the real work with it. Now that the teaching is done, let the teaching begin. Begin to work it into our hearts and into our lives, Lord. As we cherish your word, as we hold on to it, give it the value that it deserves. Give it the place in our hearts and in our lives that it deserves. Thank you, Jesus. Bless the congregation as we go home and finish out our week. In the name of Jesus, we pray these things. Amen. Amen.